Good morning, everybody. This paper is entitled Shifting Fortunes for Family Planning, The Role of Norms, and it's co-authored with Katie Quissel, who's sitting here in the audience. And the study is funded by a grant that I want to acknowledge from the University of North Carolina. And we have no relationships or conflict of interest to disclose for this study. The thrust of this paper is that it's a study of actors who have been involved globally in encouraging low-income countries to adopt family planning and other reproductive health services. And we're not trying to make a case, although we believe a case should be made, so much as to critically reflect on the history of these efforts to advance family planning. Those familiar with this history will be quite familiar with the long-standing tensions between feminist and population stabilization camps in this field. A population stabilization camp that has been in existence since the 1950s, whose primary concern has been ensuring that countries stabilize populations in order to promote economic and social development, and perceive that it's useful to give people access to family planning to lower fertility. A feminist camp focused on the rights of women to control reproduction, especially emergent since the mid-1990s, that's been critical of the population stabilization camp and that has demanded that women be taken as subjects, not objects of policy. Now, there have been many studies of these tensions. What's new about this paper is, first, an emphasis on trying to understand the normative underpinnings of these tensions. Second, we bring the state of relationships between these streams up to date to the present in this paper. Thirdly, we make an argument and find evidence that there's some overlap in the belief systems, despite claims to the contrary. And fourthly, we make an argument that these internal tensions are maybe hampering the capacity of these actors to counter common external components or opponents, for instance, elements of the Catholic Church. These tensions, of course, are hardly the only influence on national population policies. There are many, many domestic factors that shape policies that are equally or probably more important. But these are potentially a major influence on these policies and dynamics, and therefore critical to study. So the backdrop to this study is the observation that over the past decade, there's been a stagnation in resources for family planning. This has occurred even as global health funding from major donors has tripled over the same time period. The evidence indicates that there's been a global stall in the rise in uptake in the use of contraception in most low-income countries. So we surveyed analysts and studies of why this phenomenon is occurring, and they advance multiple hypotheses about this stagnation. We're not trying to make a case as to whether these are right or wrong, but these are the hypotheses that are presented in scholarship. One is that this stems from Bush administration inattention to this issue, and traditionally the U.S., or across time, the U.S. has been the largest funder of family planning services. A second hypothesis is the perception that with HIV/AIDS and higher mortality from that, that family planning is perceived to no longer be needed as a priority. A third hypothesis is that this has to do with competing priorities, such as HIV/AIDS, which make claims on scarce donor resources. A fourth is that this has been associated with the identification of family planning with coercion, especially in China and India. And finally, and perhaps most germane to this, the hypothesis is advanced that after the 1994 Conference on Population and Development, family planning becomes one among many issues in an integrated reproductive health agenda, and they argue that it loses a clear identity. So the validity of these hypotheses we're not commenting on, but these are ones that are presented to try to explain this phenomenon. So the way we did this study, we relied on several sources of data. First of all, a total of 48 interviews with key actors involved in family planning and other reproductive health services globally and nationally, 17 of which we did with actors involved in both of these camps, including leaders of international women's groups, European and U.S. donors, U.N. agencies, globally prominent demographers. We also drew on a database of 31 other interviews with family planning leaders, which were not conducted by us. We analyzed primary documents from donors and population conferences, and we drew on secondary historical analyses of the history of these groups and tensions among them. Theoretically, we draw on theory from political science, and specifically a branch of that, international relations, and a thrust in that which is called constructivism. The essence of this is constructivism focuses on norms, the shared beliefs among communities of actors concerning what constitutes appropriate behavior. This kind of tradition of analysis of norms is heavily prevalent in the discipline of sociology, where it's almost taken for granted that individuals acquire their beliefs not simply through their own decision-making processes, but their influence from their peers. As political scientists, constructivism is embraced in parts of that discipline with the idea that countries, too, can be seen in the same light. So countries don't necessarily have a priori priorities or preferences, but they're socialized by other countries and other governments to come to a decision as to what they prefer, including the actors we're talking about here who try to influence this norm-shaping behavior. Among the actors in the field, and what we're calling it is the field of population and sexual and reproductive health and rights, population SRHR, to try to bring together or give a name to this field. They sometimes use that term. The actors aren't always necessarily thinking about the norms that they're promoting or that they're trying to promote norms. They perceive themselves to be advancing certain sets of ideas that are correct. But we're looking at the way they're aiming to socialize other nation states. So let me turn to the findings. I thought this photo kind of illustrated some of the central concerns here. So we confirmed with our interviews the ongoing presence of these two what we call dominant normative streams among distinct group of actors. The first one, we chose the term ecological. And this is a group of actors who are concerned with the aggregate effects of individual behavior. And here you can think about how individuals and couples through their reproductive decision making have effects on the wider society and economy through their individual behavior, accumulated individual behavior, one of which is degradation of the environment. So the ecological folk have a particular focus on that. They're called many names, population controllers, population stabilization, neo-Malthusians. In this paper, we tried to step back and do our best to find a more neutral term so to try to take a measure of impartiality. It was difficult to find a term because names and labeling are heavily present in this field. These actors advocate for widespread provision of family planning in order to control fertility and avoid adverse effects on society of rapid population growth. The other stream, often called feminists, advocates for sexual and reproductive health and rights, we just call this the rights stream because the focus is on this woman. and the concern with the individual rights of women, the advocacy for the integrated provision of family planning and other reproductive health services, including maternity care, safe abortion, STDs, so that women can live meaningful and productive lives. This stream is critical of the aggregate thrust of the ecological norm for treating women as objects, and it gets criticized for being potentially coercive. Many actors in this stream believe that if population is indeed a problem, it will naturally be handled by giving women control over their bodies. So the history, and it's a critical reflection on the history. A few points here with respect to that history. The ecological norm is dominant from the 1950s to the 1990s. Academic institutions in U.S. and Europe identify a population problem. Foundation leaders finance this work of population specialists. UN global conferences provide forums for experts to discuss this. The U.S. government in the 1960s becomes a critical actor by coming to view rapid population growth as a potential leading to potential political instability and as a security threat, ultimately contributes more than 50% of global funding for population across time. And as evidence of the embrace of this norm, not solely because of these international actors, but in part, you see the diffusion of population policies aimed at lowering fertility rates from the 1950s on across many low-income countries. Now, of course, as people who know this history are well aware of, several challenges emerge in the 60s and 70s to this norm. In Bucharest, in the 1974 population conference, low-income countries say this is an issue of global economic inequality and argue that development is the best contraceptive, challenging this norm. The Vatican emerges as a challenger of this norm in 1969, for instance, issuing a decree opposing any form of artificial contraception. And we see that countries with large Catholic populations, such as the Philippines, experience a backlash against family planning. But, of course, the biggest challenge occurs in 1994 in Cairo, where women's groups are organizing since the mid-1980s. And in Rio, in a conference in Rio just before Cairo, activists from the South and North produced the Rio Statement, which frames family planning in the context of a broader set of rights. Cairo, of course, is different from prior international population conferences in having a large NGO presence that influences the agenda. The Cairo Program of Action has a strong focus on gender, avoids the term population problem, and family planning is only a short subsection of the document. There's a call for an integrated reproductive health agenda that emerges from Cairo and thereafter. So after Cairo, the rights norm looks especially bright. There's an upsurge in funding for reproductive health. Countries are influenced by this norm, especially in Latin America and South Asia. And for a decade, among donor agencies, discussion of population recedes in favor of a focus on reproductive health and rights. But then, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, things become much more complex for both the rights and ecological norms. First and foremost, there's, as many people know, there's no mention of population or reproductive health in the MDGs enacted in 2001. And this appears, the evidence suggests this appears to be a combination of political dynamics within the United States as well as among the G77, the group of non-aligned nations. With respect to the G77, as the MDG goals are being enacted, the G77 wishes to operate on consensus. And while there are some nation states, such as Brazil, heavily supportive of reproductive health and rights, the G77 also includes nation states like Libya and the Sudan, which object to the reproductive health agenda. And wanting to operate on consensus, they concede the terrain and avoid pushing for reproductive health and rights. Likewise, as the MDGs are being formulated, the UN Secretariat, which is in charge of putting this together, is aware that the Bush administration has come to power and would object to a strong reproductive health and rights language in the MDGs and acquiesces. All this is aimed at consensus building and not trying to push the fold or trying to bring everybody on board. Another element of a difficult situation for both norms is we see that across the decade 1998 to 2008, family planning as a percentage of total population and reproductive health funding from donors declines from 43 to 6%. But since 2005, and very much in reaction to some of these reversals, a renewal of advocacy occurs. So in 2005, a goal on universal access to reproductive health is added to MDG 5 on maternal survival. African ministers of health adopt a policy framework, Maputo, that includes family planning. The Obama administration reverses the Bush-era declines in support for family planning. And we find, and this I think is a new thing, element in the literature on this, the resurgence of what we call a modified ecological norm alongside the rights norm. And what's this? Well, the ecological norm and the set of actors embracing this persist, but they modify their norm, they sustain their concern for population stabilization, but the language they use is heavily rights-based and anti-coercion. And clearly this reflects the influence of the Cairo agenda on the way they speak and talk and use discourse. This is facilitated in 2006 by a parliamentary hearings in the United Kingdom on the subject after a decade of silence on population, where experts engage in parliamentary hearings in the United Kingdom, and a document is produced that gets widely circulated among donor communities. The resurgence of modified ecological norm is also evident in discussion in the media. So, for instance, in the wake of the UN raising its population projections for the year 2100 from 9 to 10.1 billion just a couple months ago, you see front page articles appearing in the New York Times, discussion of population stabilization. And today, allegedly the seventh billion person on Earth being born, although who knows how they can figure that out when exactly it happens. But anyway, this becomes front page, newsworthy items. Plus, addition to this, the added impetus of climate change shaping these norms. So where are we at present? There are still clear tensions among these normative streams and camps. One manifestation of this is divergent priorities among donors. So Northern Europeans, the Swedes, for instance, the Dutch, focus on sexual and reproductive health and rights and use that language and discourse. The term family planning does not appear in their discourse, in their donor priorities and so forth. Whereas a lot of the other donors, especially from Anglo-Saxon countries, the Americans, the Australians, the British, Gates Foundation, do have a heavy focus on family planning and seem to be operating from a modified ecological norm. The most stark evidence of the persistence of tensions we asked every single interviewee the first question, the same question, and that was, what is the legacy of Cairo? We just put it that way. We didn't comment. We just wanted to see what they said. And it was clear there were three camps, three kinds of responses. One response was this was a watershed event that altered global priorities for the better and a much-needed corrective to the legacies of the past and mistakes of the past. A second group of actors saw it as mixed, arguing that it was very good, indeed, that that rights were injected into this debate, but it was unfortunate that a focus was taken off family planning and that discussion of population was silenced. A third group viewed Cairo largely as negative, that it took the focus off family planning and population and ultimately harmed women by leading to more unwanted pregnancies. But we also found some evidence amidst the persistence of tensions of convergence, at least with respect to language and policy, if not with respect to deeper normative beliefs. And this is an area where we're still doing some analysis and thinking about different levels, language, policy, and normative beliefs. Actually, I'll just show that in a second. So almost all the ecological stream actors, the population stabilization folk, accept, or at least in their discourse, speak of rights as a justification. This arguably was not occurring 10, 15 years ago, clearly influencing the legacy, or an influence of Cairo. Many right stream actors accept the legitimacy now of speaking about population's effects on society, perhaps evidence of the influence of the ecological norm on the right stream. And at a policy level, almost all in both streams, and by the way, neither stream is monolithic. There are differences, divergences of opinion in both, but we do see widespread groupings, nevertheless. But most people in both streams want renewed attention to ensuring that women have access to contraception so that they can make informed choices about fertility. Here's some illustrative quotes. The first that may suggest some form of convergence, to what degree we're unsure. The first quote is from a leader, a very prominent leader in the ecological stream globally, and the second is from a very prominent leader, one of the most prominent, in the right stream. And I ask you to just read those two. Can everybody see them? Okay, then I won't read them out loud. If you could just read those for a second. Okay, so what we observe in these and other statements is a common concern that suggests some form of convergence in the idea that there's a concern that women can lead meaningful and productive lives free from coercion. But there's obvious differences about the consequences and legitimacy of placing ecological concerns at the center of debates. But there's an overlap in this concern for the power, women's autonomy and power. On the other hand, as I presented this last week, these quotes, someone, I think, rightfully pointed out a difference here, that this is a concern for women, and this is a concern about control, the control that women themselves have. So that's an interesting point of difference that may mask some normative differences between these camps. So just a few concluding comments. Of course, it's the case that many other factors besides these global debates shape population family planning policy in low-income countries. However, these debates do matter. They matter in several ways. They influence what donors think is important, and therefore their funding decisions. And this is especially important because the majority of low-income countries rely heavily on external funds for population activities. Secondly, these actors in the field, whether it's women's rights groups leaders, UN officials, demographers, or others, they maintain normative influence, even if they don't wield huge control over resources. They're listened to. And finally, that these differences hamper the ability of field actors to develop compelling positions on where and why resources should be provided. So we conclude this paper by making the case that energy spent on these internal debates, that while important in order to highlight neglected issues and areas of disagreement, that they also in some ways are counterproductive, especially since there appear to be points of overlap and moves toward the center. That sometimes these debates divert energy away from countering those who oppose access to family planning and other reproductive health services in the first place. And as an observation for the future, it will be interesting to observe whether the field is shaped from without by external developments not under its control, such as opposition from the Catholic Church and other entities, or new global political agreements that follow the MDGs, or rather whether field actors are able to reacquire a powerful voice and are able to take advantage of the political opportunities that may come their way. Thank you.